I don't really know what quantum thermodynamics is, so I'm using that term because I guess there's not really a. It's still kind of early days in sort of trying to figure out what we're doing. So I'm interested in thermodynamics of small systems, and so this is joint work recently with Michał Horodecki, and I'll also maybe talk a little bit about a paper we put out about the same time with a number of other authors, including Rob Speckens, who's here. So what I want to talk about is limitations in thermodynamics and also kind of laws, what laws of thermodynamics there might be. Roughly speaking, I think this is very rough. You can, I think, divide the history of thermodynamics into kind of maybe two areas. Initially, people were, like Sadie Carnot, they were interested in heat engines. So you have some steam engine and you want to know, does nature impose any fundamental limitation on the efficiency of a heat engine? And the history of thermodynamics, it reminds me a lot of the history of quantum information theory and quantum computation. In some sense, they were trying to understand whether nature imposed limitation on the kinds of engineering work that they were trying to do, like build engines. And in quantum computation, we have some new technology, these quantum computers, and we're trying to understand, does nature impose any fundamental limitations on computation or on performing other sorts of tasks, communication tasks, et cetera, et cetera. So quantum information theory took, I think, as its inspiration, the early days of thermodynamics. And initially, people were just kind of gathering phenomena, doing experiments, heating up water, seeing that there was a relationship between, mechanical work and work that it could be contained in heat, and things like that. So they were just kind of initially just gaining some phenomena in this kind of new field of thermodynamics. And eventually, what I think there was kind of a second wave where people began to understand that all this phenomena that they were calling thermodynamics actually had some statistical origin, and that behind everything was something they called Maxwell, I think, started calling it statistical mechanics, or I think he called it statistical thermodynamics initially. So people like Boltzmann and Gibbs understanding that a heat bath was some statistic, you could write a heat bath as some probability distribution. And that it had a certain spectrum of energies, et cetera, et cetera. So kind of understanding that underneath this, there was statistical mechanics. And I'm not really sure, but I'd like to think that we're kind of approaching a third wave in the history of thermodynamics. I think it started probably the first kind of use of information theory to understand thermodynamics. So it's this kind of an information wave in understanding thermodynamics, I think, is due to Landau and Bennett. And they used information concepts to basically exorcise Maxwell's demon. So as a lot of you probably know, people in the early days of thermodynamics were worried, what if I have a little creature, a demon, that can measure the position of particles very precisely, and then based on that, maybe this little demon has a lot of control over the system. And they could, for example, put a piston in this box. So if they find that the particle is on the left-hand side, they can put a piston on the right-hand side, and they can draw work. And so by this demon, basically, by having very precise control over the molecules in a gas, could violate the second law. And people were concerned about this. And what Landauer and Bennett did was they basically showed that, no, the second law wasn't violated when you took into account information theory. They basically said, well, this demon, when it's running around, it has to, it's acquiring information. It has to store this information in its brain. And then eventually, if you want to have a cyclic process, if you want to go back to the initial state of the demon, you have to erase the memory of the demon. And when you do that, you account for that, for erasing of the demon's brain, the information in the demon's brain, then you restore the second law. So they use information theory to understand something that people were very puzzled about in the early days of thermodynamics and statistical mechanics. So I think now we're in kind of an initial stages of a third wave of thermodynamics where we're seeing that information is playing a big role in thermodynamics. And this is both classical information theory and quantum information theory. And in this talk, we'll find that both we can find out new things in ordinary thermodynamics and also in the case where we have quantum systems. And we actually recently had a conference at ETH in kind of information and thermodynamics, and maybe just a summary of the kinds of results that people are getting. At the moment, I think, again, we're in the era of just kind of finding out some phenomena, applying information theory and gaining some phenomena about thermodynamics. So just to give some examples of some results which we've had recently, for example, the Gibbs state, the state of a heat bath, you know, you often think of it as, in statistical mechanics, that I have some ignorance. So I have some ignorance of the microstates of the system. And people have shown that, no, you can think about it as you have some pure quantum state, which you have as maximal knowledge of, or at least as maximal knowledge as we can get about in quantum theory. And only when I look at part of the system, then I see that I get a Gibbs state. So you can have full knowledge and still have a statistical interpretation of thermodynamics. You can have a daemon that has information about a system, and then they can use that information to extract work. Well, what if we know in quantum information theory we can have negative information. So recently people have found out what a natural interpretation of having negative information is, and how that applies in thermodynamics. And also very recently, people have been looking at how small could you make a fridge? How small can I make a heat engine? So can I have a heat engine which is just a qubit or a trit? So people have found heat engines which are, for example, I think the smallest one so far is a trit, maybe 2 qubits, that sort of thing. And then for quite a long time in the lab, people have been looking at micro machines, micro engines, and you often get kind of these papers, oh, using a micro engine, we can violate the second law, or things like that. So there's kind of people designing these very tiny engines. And so it's also of experimental interest. Maybe I'll just pause for a moment. I guess because it's a mixed audience of people from very many different fields, if people have any questions, they should just interrupt me at any point. This can be very informal, so. Let me know if you have a question. Good.
You mentioned how in the thermodynamics, full knowledge implies that you still have a probability distribution description. Could you expand on that just a little bit more?
What they did was I could imagine that I have a pure state on a very large system, and if I look at part of the system, it'll have a density matrix because I'm tripped. So I have a pure quantum state, but if I just look at part of the system, it'll be in the Gibbs state. And they showed, probably not surprisingly for people that do a lot of information theory, that with very high probability if I pick a random pure state, then with very high probability, if I look at the subsystem, it will be in the Gibbs state. People have also been playing around with thermalization times, like how, you know, this is a random state. How long does it take you to generate something which is random enough that you would get the Gibbs state when I look at part of the system? So people now have been looking a lot at thermalization times. I haven't put that up here because I think at the moment it's a very difficult problem. We don't have a very clean result, but that's kind of another topic of interest relating to that, to your question, I think. Okay, so what I guess we don't have at the moment is, when I said I don't know really what quantum thermodynamics is, I think that's kind of true. Part of the reason you get these funny papers occurring occasionally saying that we've violated the second law is because I don't think we have a very precise definition of what it is, what thermodynamics is, when we go to the micro regime. So I think we need a more rigorous theory. We have the 3 laws of thermodynamics, or the 4 laws, depending on who's counting, of thermodynamics. And you can ask, well, what are there analogous laws for quantum thermodynamics? Do they look the same? And then once you've done that, you can ask questions like, how much work can you draw from a system, from a particular configuration? What are the limitations that nature imposes? Is it just the ones that are imposed in the classical case, in the case of large systems, or is there something more? And the reason it's a bit difficult is because to do these sorts of things is because we're doing something which seems to be against the very fundamentals of thermodynamics. So, you know, in some ways, we always, in thermodynamics, we're taking the thermodynamic limit. We're always going to have, you know, we take many particles, large volumes, the heat bath becomes infinite, and only in that very large limit do we recover a lot of our thermodynamic results. And I think that's the key difficulty that we face. So number of particles is going to infinite, and we want to do the opposite. We're looking, what I'm interested here is I'm looking at thermodynamics in the opposite extreme. I want to look at thermodynamics of small quantum systems, or even thermodynamics of at the nanoscale. So a lot of these results I'll mention apply to thermodynamics at the nanoscale. So can we do thermodynamics without going to the thermodynamic limit? So let me just outline the remainder of the talk. What I'll show is that we can, so I'll start with the results, just if people, if they just want the punchlines. So the punchline basically is that the standard free energy of thermodynamics gets replaced by two different free energies. So you get two free energies, and they're different. I'll explain how you can kind of, I think, make a rigorous laws of quantum thermodynamics, and then I'll explain, given that we have this kind of picture or this paradigm for quantum thermodynamics, I'll explain how roughly we get these results. And the results, I think what's nice is they come from two, we get the results by looking at two things. One is something called a resource theory, which is something that has come about in quantum information theory, largely. This notion of a resource theory. So we'll exploit what I would call the kind of some results from resource theories. And it's kind of a bit ironic in that resource theories were kind of originally, a lot of the reason for coming up with resource theories in quantum information theory came out of an analogy with thermodynamics. And now we're kind of going full circle and applying that back to thermodynamics. So it's kind of a cute circular story. The other thing we're going to exploit is that in information theory, we've started doing what we call single-shot information theory. So usually when you do things like, say you want to compress information, well, you need to have many, you usually do that with many, a large book, say, or what we call large block size. So you basically, you wait in information theory, you wait until you get, you compress many words at the same time. You don't just compress a letter or something like that. So if you want to compress information like you do all the time when you use a JPEG, so a JPEG is like a compressed photograph, you're compressing the information in a photograph so that your file size is smaller. Usually you need to take a nice big photograph and then you compress it. If you just want to compress a few pixels or something, that is much harder. Well, recently we've been looking at those sorts of things. How do you compress information when you just have a few pixels or something like that? So I'm going to apply results from that to understanding single small systems in the thermodynamic case. And it's kind of natural that if we can do information theory, not just when we have very large pictures, but when we just have a few pixels, it's kind of natural then that if you want to, that those tools can be applied to the case where instead of looking at many particles in thermodynamics, we just have a few particles. And that's, I think, the key kind of tool that we use. Is that kind of idea clear? Is it a mixed up audience that people, when I talk about compression, people know what that means? Information compression? All the information theorists are nodding their heads. Okay. I'll maybe try and expand it a bit. But if people have questions, I can just go to the blackboard at any point. So I'll just sketch then some of the ideas, you know, what thermodynamical transitions are possible, when do we have reversibility, how small can efficient heat engines be. I'll kind of sketch the ideas behind that. Okay, ooh. Okay. So let me just kind of review thermodynamics. I'll review kind of the key ideas of the kinds of thermodynamics that I'll be interested in. So here we have a heat bath, a temperature T, and we have this box which has a gas in half the cylinder. And it's not in equilibrium, because if you stick this box, to the heat bath, what's going to happen? Well, the gas will slowly expand until it's completely expanded, and then it will be in equilibrium. And while it's expanding, it's going to raise this bucket, which could be a weight at some weights. And so what we're doing is, because the system is out of equilibrium with the heat bath, we're extracting work from the system. All right? So we're extracting work because we're lifting the bucket. So we're doing with lifting a weight, that's work. And it's out of equilibrium. And so the expansion of the box is basically what we're using to draw work. So we can effectively draw an amount of work from this resource, this box, which has only a gas in half the one of the partitions, one of the two partitions. All right? So that's a standard kind of thing you do in thermodynamics. And you probably have all come across the free energy. This is the Helmholtz free energy. So it's just basically what it is it tells us how much work we can extract from a system which is out of equilibrium at constant temperature. So basically, if we plug in this box, if we plug it into here and compute the free energy of this resource, then it'll tell us how much work we can extract. And the work is basically just the difference of free energy between the initial state and the final state. All right? And now you can also, the free energy plays another role. So it also plays the role of telling us which thermodynamical transitions are possible. So the free energy can only go down spontaneously. So it basically tells us that if we have a system, we want to know, will it go to another state thermodynamically, then it will, or it can, if the free energy is larger in the initial state than in the final state. So the free energy, this is important, the free energy, the key message here is the free energy plays two roles. One is it tells us when we can go from some initial state to some final state, whether when a thermodynamical transition is possible. And the other thing is it tells us how much work we can draw from a particular resource. And another example is if we have a heat bath at some temperature, and now we want to know if we can, we can use this to basically tell how much we can, if we want to run a Carnot cycle between two different heat baths at different temperature, that's also the kind of thing we can analyze by looking at the free energy. Is that clear to people? Do people have any questions about that? So now, what are we going to do? We are interested in the thermodynamics of small systems. So rather than lifting a weight, that's work. Work is lifting a weight. Work here is going to be taking a two-level system, which is in some ground state, and exciting it to some excited state. Okay, that's work in the micro-regime. And that's, I think, one of the key points here, is that we replace the lifting of a weight by just the exciting of an atom. So it's in its ground state. It goes to some excited state. The difference in energy tells us roughly how much work we've done. Okay. And because this is a single bit, we call this a work bit or a wit. And what we find now when we compute the free energy in the micro regime, in the case where we have quantum systems or small systems, what we find is that the free energy, so this quantity here, no longer governs how much work we can draw from a system. Instead, what happens is that we get two different free energies. And I'll explain what those two different ones mean. But we get basically two different free energies, one F max and one called F min. And not surprisingly, F max is larger than F min. It doesn't. So my operations will be defined on the whole system. But I can always describe any open quantum system in terms of a closed quantum system. So I prefer to think of it like that. Is that what you mean? Is that what your question is?
Or? I was just wondering if that qubit, that two-level system, has to be imagined in an environment, or if it's closed and I just have to worry about the two-level system. So there will be no interaction in between that two-level systems over there and something else?
Oh, no. I'm going to, if I'm going to raise this atom, it's going to have to be coupled in some way to my systems, because otherwise it would just sit there. I want to draw work from a system. So I'm going to have, just like here, this is the weight, this is just this object here, and you're right, in this diagram I've coupled it to my resource. here I will also need to couple it to a resource in order to excite the atom. So my goal will be basically to couple this to a resource and a heat bath and then excite it. That's basically, and then I've drawn work. That's kind of the goal. So why this F min and F max? Well, it turns out F min tells us how much work we can extract from a resource. So we have, say, a few number of molecules here, just a tiny microscopic little heat engine. We draw some work, and F min will tell us how much work we can draw. In thermodynamics, we can always do the reverse process. We can add work, and we can, by pushing in this piston here, adding work. So here, the piston comes out, and we get work. Here, we push in a piston, and by adding in work, we get back the initial state of the system. And in ordinary thermodynamics, that's completely can be made reversible. The amount of work that we gained here is just the amount of work that we need to do the reverse process. And it will turn out that in the case of, in the microregime, that's not the case. There is a difference between, so it turns out that F min governs how much work we can draw from a system, and F max tells us how much work we have to add in order to get back that system. Okay, and it turns out that they're different. So that is, in some sense, the fundamental limitation, or one of the fundamental limitations that I'm talking about. There's an irreversibility at the microregime. You cannot put in the same amount of work to get back your system. You need to put in much more. So all processes will have a fundamental irreversibility that nature imposes when I go to the microregime. OK, so let me just give a summary of the major results. So we'll basically, I'll outline a paradigm for quantum thermodynamics, and I'll show that, I won't show, but I will tell you what F min is, at least. The proofs I can either, happy to talk to people after, or they're in a paper which is just recently on the archive. So it turns out that distillation of work is given by F min, the formation of states is given by F max. We also find a criteria for state-to-state transformations, which is kind of a generalization of the free energies, I think. So free energy, remember, in the textbook, in your thermodynamics textbook, the free energy tells you when you can go from one state to another state. Here we find a criteria for that, which we call thermomajorization. And we find that there's two kinds of irreversibility. There's irreversibility due to finite size effects and irreversibility due to quantum effects. And so I will outline how you get both, or what the source of both of those things are. And I won't talk about, I don't know how much I'll talk about the last two things, but we find necessary and sufficient conditions for having reversibility in the microregime. And also, we've looked at these little refrigerators, or these little Carnot cycles, and we find that they're actually not operating at the Carnot efficiency, as far as we can tell. So you get a fundamental limitation of these small fridges and small engines. OK, so let me talk about now resource theories, which, even if you don't care about thermodynamics, they're actually a very interesting way to look at a theory. So I'll talk about resource theories. And the one that we're using here is one that I think started mostly with Dominic Jancic, and then has kind of gone some evolution, a little bit of evolution from that. And the paradigm, I guess, I'm going to talk about it in the context of a resource theory. So let me just say, give some examples of resource theories so you get a sense of what they're good for and what context they've been used in. So entanglement is a resource theory, I think, was probably, at least in the context of quantum information theory, is kind of where it started. So entanglement is a good thing. We want to use it to perform various tasks. We want to know how much we have. And so we should treat it like a resource, which we want to kind of distill, get some. We want to get some entanglement. We want to use some entanglement. It's a resource. And that's, I think, how resource theory sort of started. You can look, though, at other kinds of resource theories. We've looked at the notion of purity, where having a pure state becomes a resource because you're in a world where all your operations are noisy, for example. And then Rob and Gilad have, Gilad Gur and Rob Speckens have looked at, you know, if you have conservation laws, then you get resources because of that. And we've also found, using a resource theory, I guess, quite a number of years ago, this kind of quantumness as a resource, which is related to this discord thing that people have recently become interested in. So here's kind of a chart of some of the kind of, classic resource theories and what are the important things to consider. So we have some theory, entanglement theory, the theory of purity, the theory of asymmetry. And the key way of defining these theories is you just consider some class of operations, right? So that's, I think, how the resource theory starts. Just give me a class of operations. Tell me what I'm allowed to do in your theory. What am I allowed to do? So, for example, in entanglement theory, what are you allowed to do? You're allowed to do local operations. So you have Alice and Bob. They're allowed to do local operations, and they're allowed to communicate over a telephone. So that's often called LOCC, local operations in classical communication, and that's what you're allowed to do in your theory. Our theory of purity, what we had was you're allowed to do noisy operations. In other words, you're allowed to do all unitaries, and you're allowed a source of noise, and that's it. Okay. And then in this theory of asymmetry, you have a conservation law. So you have, you have to conserve angular momentum, or you have to conserve energy, or whatever. And so you're only allowed to do operations which are invariant under the action of the group. So you can only do things which, say, conserve angular momentum. And as soon as you impose, as soon as you specify a class of operations, you immediately get a bunch of useless states. Okay? So for example, entanglement theory, you specified a class of operations, LOCC, and then you get a bunch of states which you can create for free. So if I am allowed LOCC, I can create all the separable states I want. I can just create them for free. So they form a closed set, they're useless states. And they're kind of the free states. They become kind of distinguished. So you suddenly, by specifying a class of operations, you distinguish a set of states. And I'll call this the closed set, or S. So for example, so separable states are the states you can create under LOCC. Noisy states are trivially they turn out to be the only states that you can create under noisy operations. And if you're allowed, if you can only do things which, say, commute with the angular momentum, then, eigenstates of angular momentum become the states that you can create for free. And anything else, like a superposition of angular momentum, becomes something you cannot create for free. All right? So, for example, I can't, using noisy operations, create purity. I give you a pure state. So that becomes a resource. So what happens is you specify a class of operations. And once you specify the class of operations, you get a bunch of useless states, so states which you can create under the class of operations. But that immediately tells you that all other states are a resource. All right? So all states which are not separable are entangled. And that becomes the resource. And it becomes difficult. You cannot create entangled states using LOCC. Just like now, if the useless state is just pure noise, then anything which has some purity, like a pure state, you cannot create under the class of operations of noisy operations, and suddenly pure states become a resource. If all the operations you can do are those that, say, commute with some generator, like, say, angular momentum, then suddenly something which is in a superposition of angular momentum becomes a resource and becomes something that you want and you need. All right, is that clear? And that turns out to be a very powerful way to describe to describe a theory, because you start to immediately. So we showed a while ago that you get, well, there's monotone. So there's you get some quantities in these theories, which turn out to tell you immediately the rate at which, how valuable these resources are. So if I want to know how valuable is a resource, is a pure, say, is the maximally entangled state more entangled than some other state? Well, you can do it in the context of these resource theories fairly easily. You can basically look, there's something called a relative entropy distance, and it turns out that in all these theories, the relative entropy distance has a special role, and what it does is it tells you how useful a resource is, and it tells you how well you can interconvert one resource into another. There's some exceptions to this, So we have a theorem which basically tells us when this holds. But generically, for many theories, it turns out that there's some quantity which basically, it's the same quantity in every single theory. It's basically some distance to the closed set. So, for example, the relative entropy of entanglement is the distance of your state to the separable states, and that tells you how good your entanglement is. The distance to the maximally mixed state tells you how pure your state is, and that turns out to be the entropy, actually. You get an analogous thing in these asymmetric theories. I'm allowed to do any unitary, and I'm allowed to add the maximally mixed state. That's it. So we usually try and, we want to try and make these operations as simple as possible. And let me just say that thermodynamics is a combination of just these two theories. So what is thermodynamics? It'll be basically a combination of noisy operations and asymmetric operations. Why? Because noise, entropy is a resource, purity is a resource in thermodynamics. A heat bath is noisy, whereas a pure work is work. Pure state is work, and we have a conservation law, which is energy. So thermodynamics is just going to be a combination of these two resource theories which have previously been studied in completely different contexts. Okay. So what is thermodynamics? So I mentioned it's just a combination. So our class of operations are the thermal, we're calling thermal operations. And it's basically that we have to conserve energy. We're allowed to do unitaries which conserve energy. And it will turn out, when you just specify that energy conserving unitaries, you find basically that the useless state is just the heat bath at temperature T. So basically, the kinds of states that I can create are basically going to be given by the heat bath, and that becomes the useless state. And if you give me a heat bath, I will not be able to do anything else than give you another heat bath back at the same temperature. So it becomes the closed set.
How exactly do you define heat bath? Like, it doesn't have to be large.
Right.
It's just either the minus
theta
H.
Yeah. The Hamiltonian can be any Hamiltonian. You can choose what Hamiltonian you want, actually. How it's defined more generally, I'm not sure. That certainly, you might be able to get away with other definitions for some other theories. But in this case, it's basically just the Gibbs state with any Hamiltonian. So I'll maybe say a bit more about that. But basically, I think the key point is that it's a combination of noisy operations and the preservation of a conservation law. So I need to conserve energy. I'm allowed to do unitaries. I'm allowed to add some heat bath, some Gibbs states. And then I think the other key point is that work is just this thing that I mentioned, that you'd have some ground state and you excite it. So that becomes work. The free energy, I mentioned there was a generic theorem which says that there's a distance measure which tells you how well you can, how good your resource is or how easily you can interconvert one resource to another. Well, I can look at the relative entropy distance to the useless state, this heat bath, and that turns out to be exactly equal to the free energy. Okay? So that is the free energy. The free energy is the relative entropy distance to the Gibbs state. And what I find now when I go to the micro regime that I get two more monotones. So these are just functions which do not increase under the class of operations. The free energy does not increase under the thermal operations. These guys also don't increase under the thermal operations. So I get basically some more functions which basically tell me how well I can convert one resource to the other when I go to the micro regime.
I guess you would have different conserved quantities.
Well, no, I mean, I guess here, you know, here we're working in the microcanonical. Well, here the heat bath I'm allowed to add is just the Gibbs state. But I mean, we're, you know, in some sense we are, I mean, it's an amalgamation of both in the sense that we are often, you know, we look at fixed energy subspaces a lot of the time. So, you know, in this case, it doesn't make a big difference in some way. You're kind of doing an amalgamation of both.
Yeah, so my...
I'm not sure that your question...
I was just wondering if it is possible to have the... to obtain the equivalence between different thermodynamical ensembles also in this framework.
Yes, I mean, what I'm describing to you is I claim is thermodynamics. So anything, basically, if you could derive it in kind of in the macroscopic regime for ordinary thermodynamics, you can derive it from this. I claim this is completely equivalent. So let's just say kind of what this framework for thermodynamics is. We're given some state, rho S, it has some Hamiltonian, and we're gonna just call this the resource, because we might wanna extract work from it. So that's the resource that we want to use to extract work. And we're only allowed to do energy conserving unitaries. And the reason that we are imposing, why do we say we're only allowed to do energy conserving unitaries? Well, because that's exactly what we're interested in. We're interested in quantifying how much energy or work we can extract from a system. So if we want to do that, we need to very precisely keep account of all the energy in our system, right? If, you know, we want to make sure that we don't sneak in extra energy in some way. You know, if I'm allowed to do some other operation which doesn't conserve energy, well then how do I know how much work I've extracted because I could have snuck in some work because I wasn't conserving energy. So if we're trying to keep track of energy, which is what we're trying to do, then we need to make sure that our operations conserve energy. Otherwise, we won't be able to properly keep track of energy. All right? So that's why we need in thermodynamics to impose energy conservation. All right? Now, you might worry, well, all the things we kind of do usually in the macroscopic regime, we don't really precisely, you know, we approximately conserve energy, but we don't do it precisely. Well, don't worry. We can take all these other paradigms and fit them within this paradigm. So this is why I said that ordinary thermodynamics fits within this framework. So for example, what you often do is you often have some external Hamiltonian, a big device, and you sit there and you manipulate your systems using this big machine in the lab. So it's an external Hamiltonian. You're changing the Hamiltonian. Well, all I do is I take my Hamiltonian, which depends on time, and I just put in a clock into the system, an internal clock, and then I just have a single Hamiltonian, which is constant in time, and all my operations commute with that. All right, so I can, by going into this internal picture, I can take care of something which people often do in the lab, which is consider a changing Hamiltonian. People often also want to add in a little interaction term. And again, you need to be careful when you add in the interaction term because you don't want to bump up, you don't want to change the energy levels. So you just say, well, initially, this interaction term is zero, or is effectively zero. Finally, it's zero. And that way, I'll be able to keep track of how much energy or work I'm extracting because there's going to be none contained in this interaction term initially and finally. So that's, again, is equivalent to having some fixed Hamiltonian. And so there's all equivalent to this, which is basically that I'm allowed to do all unitaries which commute with the Hamiltonian. Okay, so all energy-conserving operations I can just think of as equivalently unitaries which commute with the Hamiltonian. Okay, so that's what we'll be doing with the total Hamiltonian. And that can be the Hamiltonian of the system plus the heat baths plus every other thing we want to throw in there. So it's not a very, doesn't constrain us much, and we can always do it like this. Okay? And what we find is that these are the operations which preserve the Gibbs state. So the Gibbs state is just, you know, e to the minus beta h, e to the minus beta e over z, which is the partition function. And here's a quantum state. Writing this as a quantum state, the Hamiltonian we'll call hr, can be anything. And basically the Gibbs states, we find the Gibbs state is preserved by this class of operations. And so we can allow you to add as many Gibbs states as you want, and you won't actually be able to do anything interesting if all you have is Gibbs states. You won't be able to draw work by adding in Gibbs states. Okay, so we allow you to add Gibbs states for free. And now, as I said, we're interested in, can you make a transition on the work system? Can you raise its energy level? And that will tell us how much work you can extract under this class of operations. Is everything clear with that? The main thing is, energy conserving unitaries is a class of operation. Note that that encodes the first law, the second law, and the third law. They're just kind of here. If you look carefully, you will see the three laws of thermodynamics. The first law is just conservation of energy, so we already have that, energy conserving unitaries. It's not, you know, originally it was kind of some experimental fact. Here it's kind of the premise. And the entropy here is the von Neumann entropy. So things like the second law become kind of trivial, or the third law becomes kind of trivial. In some sense, the fact that that these operations preserve the Gibbs states is another way of maybe thinking of the second law of thermodynamics, that you cannot, if I give you the Gibbs state, you can't move out of the Gibbs state. You can't draw work from a heat bath because you can't, the Gibbs state just stays the Gibbs state.
Isn't that true for any state which is diagonal in the Hamiltonian eigenbasis, though?
I will indeed show you a state which is also preserved by the...
So is it fair to say that it's actually more the Gibbs state that's defining the theory than the...
I mean, you can... Well...
Conservation.
Yeah, you can... So there's some funny things that happen if you pick the state as the how to define the theory. Because, so let me give a good example of this actually, which is separable states. So say I say that separable states define your theory. Well, then LOCC becomes a natural class of operations. Certainly, local operations and classical communication will preserve a separable state. If I have separable states, I can't move out of that class. But there are other operations which preserve the separable state, so swap. If Alice and Bob swap their states, well, a separable state will stay a separable state, but you can do a whole bunch of other things with swap. And in fact, Fernando Brandão and other people have looked at those class of operations and find something, you know, get reversibility and things like that. So you can, it's an interesting thing to do both things. I mean, often what I like to do is start with a class of operations that defines the useless states. Now take the useless states and define a class of operations. That class of operations might be larger than your original set. Okay, so with this class of operations, we can now ask how much work we can extract, and we can ask how much work is required to go back. And this is what we find. We find, this is for people that maybe are not, well, I've tried to write it in a way which is fairly generic. So we have some state and some state rho, that's some quantum state. We decohere it in the energy eigenbasis. So I'm just giving the result here. We decohere it in the energy eigenbasis, so we just look at the diagonal part in the energy eigenbasis, we call this omega. Now it turns out you should compute this free energy with respect to omega. Okay? And the free energy for distillation is given by this thing here. It looks awful a bit, but it's not really. It's basically just, I have the Gibbs factor, the Boltzmann factor here, and I have a function which tells me, is this energy level populated or not populated? If it's populated, then I add it in the sum. If it's not populated, then it doesn't contribute here at all. And you just take this thing, which looks a bit like a partition function, but in some sense, it's the partition function of the populated energy levels. I sum it all up, and I take the log of this thing. And that is the min free energy. Okay? There'll be a little twist I'll have to give later, but that's effectively what it is. The twist is basically that I allow some probability of failing to draw work, just a tiny probability, because it turns out that we want to make an answer which is robust, and often I don't care if I with some vanishingly small probability if I fail. You know, we never do anything perfectly anyway, so you should allow for some probability of failure. And F max is related basically to the largest, it's a comparison of the eigenvalues of the Gibbs state, the largest eigenvalue in some sense between the Gibbs state and the state that's of interest. Okay? So this is F max. And like I said, this tells you how much work you can extract from a system. And this tells you how much work you need to add to get the system. And they're very different. So those look a bit complicated if you haven't seen them for the first time. I'll show you a very simple, I'll go to some nice limit where you can see that they're very simple. But let me just say that they're all related to something called to relative entropy distances. So the free energy, as I said, is related to the something called the relative entropy distance, which is this quantity here. And the F min and F max turn out to be related to something called D min and D max, which occurred in the context of single shot information theory, or just occurred in single shot information theory. So it turns out that these thermodynamical quantities we find, these two new free energies that we define, they're very closely related to information theoretic quantities which occurred in single-shot information theory. Just like you can, the ordinary free energy can also be related to an information theoretic quantity. So basically, again, if you look at things in terms of information theory, when we go to the micro-regime, you have this function which is a distance, an information distance to the Gibbs state, and it basically bifurcates into two different distances to the Gibbs state, so the dmax distance and the dmin distance. And I should mention that Johan Ahlberg has independently shown that this is a lower bound for work extraction using a particular model where you have kind of independent interactions with a heat bath. You assume that basically all these interactions are independent. So that shows in some ways that these operations we are considering here can be done very simply, just with kind of switching on and switching off, touching a system to a heat bath over and over again. And you can achieve these bounds that we have in a kind of a simple way. At least, sorry, this was in a classical case. It's a slightly different, it's a slightly different quantity. There's some subtleties with smoothing, but effectively, yeah. So just to say what's happening here, so this is work distillation. We have some quantum system, which is a resource. We have some heat bath, and we have the work bit over here in the zero state. And now we do our thermal operations, we act our thermal operations on this thing, and we get some garbage, which we throw away, and the wick is now in the raised state. And that's a thermodynamic process of drawn work in the kind of quantum or the microregime. Okay. And again, you know, you can have any Hamiltonian, but we take the Hamiltonian of the wick to just be this. It doesn't actually matter what system we use for the wit, or the work bit. It can be anything. It doesn't need to be a two-level system. We just wanted to make a joke, basically. Okay. And like I said, we have energy conservation and unitaries. And the key element behind the proof, I guess I should finish fairly quickly. The key element of the proof is that we basically, what do you need to do in order to make this transformation? What are the necessary and sufficient conditions? Well, you need to make sure that the number of states here matches the number of states here, because you're doing a unitary operation. So for every kind of string or state on the left-hand side, you need to map it to a different string on the other side, or a different state on the other side. So the rank of the initial and the final state have to be the same. And that's basically the key element of the proof. So let me just show you kind of the roughly where you get these irreversibilities. So the free energy, remember, is E. So this is maybe one of the key kind of, if you just look at this, you probably get the gist of what I'm talking about. So the free energy is E minus KTS. If I go to zeroth order F min, this other free energy, which tells you how much work you can extract, is you replace the entropy with the rank of the classical state. And the rank of the density matrix, so the number of elements which are occupied, and the rank can be much larger than the entropy. Okay? You know, because if I have a whole bunch of things that are occupied but only with some small probability, the rank can be quite large, much larger than the entropy. And that's something you have to deal with if you want to basically do operations on single systems. F max is basically related to the largest eigenvalue in this limit. And so what you basically have is you can have basically states which have very large F max. So they require a huge amount of work to create. You can get only a very small amount of work from. And maybe one example is, and this is maybe related to what Patrick was saying, for example, this pure state here, which is where the probabilities look like Gibbs factors, square root of Gibbs factors, this state here is a pure state, yet the rank of the classical density matrix is the dimension of the state. So no work can be drawn from this state at all, even though it's a pure state. And you would think that you would get at least, the KT times the dimension of the state. Now, there's cases when the rank is basically equal to the entropy. So basically, the difference is that the rank in drawing work is that the rank can be very different to the entropy. In some cases, the rank can be very close to the entropy. For example, if I have many copies of a state, and this is where we see that if we have a large number of particles, if you go to the thermodynamic limit, then these things match each other. Then F min, F max becomes the same as the traditional free energy. Because if I have a lot of particles, so here I've just written a bunch of independent particles, then it's approximately equal to the rank of the density matrix. If I allow myself to make some tiny changes to the state. So for example, if I plot a histogram of the eigenvalues of the state rho tensor n, it looks like this. Almost all the eigenvalues, almost all the probabilities of getting any particular state are almost zero, except for a bunch here, which are all approximately equal. That's basically how compression works. Compression works because of this. So if I have many states, they almost all sit here, and then I can compress by only considering these states here. Likewise here, I just don't worry about drawing work if the system is in one of these states here, because it's almost never there. I only draw work when the system is in one of these states here. Okay. A way you can think about it is if you flip a coin, if you have a coin which a third of the time is heads and two-thirds of the time is tails, then the probability of getting all, probabilities like getting all tails are very small. They're kind of, the probability of having all tails, if I flip the coin many times, is tiny. Whereas here, you have basically all the cases where roughly two-thirds of the coin tosses were heads and one-third of the coin tosses were tails. I guess Lucien, what should I probably end, I guess, now. So let me just say that there is a general, you can have a general criteria for at least classical states, which tells you when you can go from one state to another. It's based upon the majorization condition, which some of you in information theory will know about. Basically what you do, is you replace the majorization condition with something called thermomajorization condition. So in majorization, you can tell whether one state can be transformed to the other under permutations by just looking at the eigenvalues and ordering them from largest to smallest. Here, what you do is you order the eigenvalues from largest to smallest, but you include a beta factor, an inverse of a Gibbs factor. And when you do that, when you replace the majorization condition with a majorization condition where you add a Gibbs factor, then you basically get a condition, if and only if, for the diagonals for classical states, for whether you can do a transition from one state to another. So this seems to be kind of an interesting condition here, which you can use to basically determine state transformations. And I'll just mention one final thing. It turns out that when you look at the, say, a Carnot cycle involving, say, a very tiny system like these small refrigerators, they're not reversible. So you basically get entropy production, anomalous energy, sorry, additional entropy production above that which you should get based on the Carnot efficiency. So for example, we've looked at one where we have even a fairly what's a larger Carnot engine than one's usually considered, 2x3, not usually, I should say. These guys have looked at kind of heat engines with a single qubit or with three qubits. And here you basically find that even with a larger working body, you still do not attain the Carnot efficiency. Basically, what happens is the isothermal transformations you can make reversible using additional qubits, but the adiabatic processes you can't. And you have some probability of failure. So, I just have to say that result rather than explaining it. But I'm happy to talk about it after the fact. So let me just end with the conclusions, basically, and just summarize what we have here. So we basically talk about the laws of thermodynamics as basically being like this, just that you're allowed unitary transformations and you have to conserve energy. And then, as a consequence of that, we see that these are the operations which preserve the heat bath. And so we can think of the laws of thermodynamics as just being this stuff here. Okay? Preservation of heat bath under this class of operations which conserve energy. And if you want to talk about entropy, it's the Bernoulli entropy. We find that we have two free energies which can be really different. One which tells me how much work I can extract from a system. One which tells me how much work I need to put into a system to get a state. And because they're different, you have some fundamental irreversibility when you have a small system. So the limitations we're getting, they're due to two things. One is finite size, and one is due to the quantum that you can have quantum superpositions of energy. We have a process, kind of an efficient way of computing whether you can make a state transformation between two states called thermomajorization. And we have necessary and sufficient conditions for knowing when that criteria allows for reversibility. And finally, we can apply this to understand these small heat engines and decide whether they're efficient or not. So that's just kind of an application of this. So with that, I'll thank you very much for your attention.
If you start with a state which commutes with Hamiltonian of system, you can never get a state which doesn't commute with Hamiltonian.
Yes.
So it means that the criterion to tell you that, I mean, whether a state can be transformed to the other or not is not, I mean, not only depends to the free energy, but also depends to the asymmetry of the states.
Yes.
So
when I mentioned that the thermomajorization criteria we have is only for classical states. So you don't, it's the case where you don't have the superposition.
But my point is that, I mean, with this framework, with this set of, with this restriction or quantum operation you put, I guess you're putting more restriction than what is required to study thermodynamics, because, I mean, I don't see why that transition should be impossible.
I think it should be impossible. So if you want to allow that, then you will also be allowing ways to sneak in energy, basically. So, I mean, you might want to consider a theory where I'm allowed to... I mean, what you might want to do is say, I want to, on average, conserve energy or something like that. The problem with that is that work, you need to define work very precisely as... You need to be careful that you don't introduce additional entropy or something into your system.
But, I mean, if you... think about this set of operations, then the set of condition you get, not only, I mean, you get a set of condition which depends on the asymmetry of the states, like how
yes.
much asymmetry the initial state has,
yes.
and how much asymmetry.
That's right. So it turns out that you don't, when you look at large systems, you don't get that. So for example, when you go IID, when you go to the thermodynamic limit, the asymmetry doesn't matter. You recover the, so if you have a quantum system, you recover the classical result. And the reason is simple. The reason is that the amount of superposition you need is minuscule, and basically you use a sublinear amount of superposition. So if you consider superposition as a resource, the amount that you're using is sublinear in the number of copies. So it sounds like it's a resource, you might think, but because it's sublinear in the number of copies, it goes to zero. So the amount of resource you need as a rate is zero.
Okay, that's so any more questions?
Yeah, good question. How do fmin and fmax end up behaving in the thermodynamic limit?
They approach the free energy.
And how does that work out? It looked like they were...
So I was... So an example would be... I'm sure there's a quick way to... When I was mentioning the... Here we go. So you can think of... I mean, this is a very... Okay, so let me give a toy. This will be a toy example. Toy example of thermodynamic limit, which is just that I have very little long-range interactions, and I can almost treat my individual particles as being independent, okay? Like an ideal gas or something. So in an ideal gas, I just have the same density matrix, many copies. In that case, the entropy, if I plot, as I said, the histogram of the probabilities for each energy state, it's very highly peaked here. And this width is basically given to it by the entropy. So now if I just cut these tails here, the rank of this density matrix is basically, the log of the rank is equal to the entropy. So that's how you get the entropy, that's how the F min approaches the ordinary free energy. F max approaches as well, and that's just because all the eigenvalues are roughly the same, and so the largest eigenvalue is not that different to all the other eigenvalues.
Would you comment on the origin of irreversibility for the small scale cycles?
So it's just this fact that the rank, only when you go to the thermodynamic limit does the rank approach the entropy, the rank of a density matrix approach the entropy. So,
do you have any more physical picture for it?
So let's say you have let's just take a two-level system, and with some probability it's ground, with some probability it's excited. You have to, when you have many systems, then a lot of these probabilities become very small, and you don't need to worry about the case when the system is in this particular energy level, because it never happens, virtually. So when you have, in the thermodynamic limit, the kinds of the states that you're having to deal with are just a few, basically.
So
the energy becomes very concentrated. Whereas on a two-level system, you have some probability of it being ground and some excited, and there's no, if you have to do a transformation which raises the width, you kind of have to account for both of those things. And so there'll be, you know, you, when it's in the ground state, you might fail, and when it's in the excited state, you might succeed. But you have to succeed in both cases for you to claim that you're drawing work. Whereas in the case when you go to the thermodynamic limit, there's really, you can, the probability, these are the cases where you might fail, and they happen with almost no, you know, with vanishingly small probability. Whereas an arbitrary system, a single copy, will have probabilities all over the place, will be occupied in all kinds of different ways. So it's much less predictable in some sense. Is that kind of
yes.
A...
Any other questions? Before we thank Jonathan, let me remind you that there will be snacks downstairs in the bistro. Let's thank Jonathan again.